You're listening to the Morbid Curiosities podcast. We have no truck with profanity here, but those of you of a more squeamish disposition may wish to exercise caution before tuning in. And welcome to Morbid Curiosities, an almost brand new show about the morbidly curious for the curiously morbid. I'm your host, George Colley.
And I'm your other host, Rosie Cole. We are the principals of Gimcrack Productions, a theatre and performance company. And in our theatre making, we research morbid topics. And now we want to share all our research with you guys. So today, what do we have in our death cabinet?
Yes, we're delving into the death cabinet for a second time. Last week, if you weren't listening, we did A for alkaline hydrolysis and B for burial alive. And this week I am going to open with C, which is for burning people.
That doesn't begin with a C.
It does if you spell it cremation. I'm going to go through a history of cremation and a few fun, goofy facts about what happens when we burn people.
Cool, that definitely sounds fun and goofy, except for the burning people.
I don't know if you realise the inadvertently hilarious gag you just made there, but you said cool, and we're talking about cremation. It's not cool at all.
It's hot.
It's hot.
It's very hot.
1969. That's when cremation was invented, in 1969. it's come along nicely.
Haven't we been burning people for a really long time?
In 1969, in New South Wales, Australia, a discovery was made of some human remains which showed signs of having been cremated. Those remains came to be called the Mungo Lady, and they are dated to about 20,000 years ago.
What?
Yeah, something like 18,000 BCE. That's the earliest recorded example we have of cremation. Moving on through ancient history from there, we've got evidence of cremation in China, is one of the earliest areas, around 8000 BCE. It looks to have started in Europe and in the Near East around the year 3000 BCE. Ancient Egypt was the ancient culture which seemingly started a trend for inhumation.
What does inhumation mean?
Inhumation means burying.
From what I know of the ancient Egyptians, they like to do some incredibly elaborate type burying.
Oh, they like to bury people like a boss. Yeah. You might have heard of the pyramids. There are these triangles in Egypt and they're called pyramids.
I can't wait for the mummies episode. I'm so excited about the episode on mummies.
Really good triangles with people in.
I can't wait.
Stay tuned, folks, because the mummies episode is on its way.
I love to talk about mummies.
Just to set up some information about...
Not mummies, burning.
Burning. So that's ancient Egypt, ancient Scandinavia, Norse and Viking funerals, famously well known for involving cremation, often out on longboats. I'll tell you a story about that later. In ancient Asia, Buddhist influence areas tended to practice cremation up until about 1300 CE, with the advent of Neo-Confucianism. So cremation was a very, very big thing in India and Indian-related areas. In ancient societies in general, cremation was a military procedure.
What do you mean by that? Are people who are in the military more likely or less likely to be all burned up when they died?
More likely.
Okay.
In terms of its convenience in getting rid of corpses, large numbers of corpses on a battlefield, having to transport them home, that's just, it's just too much hassle. So it's a lot easier to find a way to just stick them in a box. Between about 2500 and 1000 BCE, we see cremation beginning to spread like wildfire.
Ooh. Oh, that burned.
Another game of... Hey! In that time, 2500 to 1000 BCE, we see cremation spreading like wildfire across Europe and into the British Isles and finally Spain and Portugal. Between 1000 and 800 BCE, and I'm just zipping through the ancient history here, in war-torn Greece... It became the dominant mode of disposal, which we know by way of Homer. It's mentioned in the Iliad and the Odyssey, as if they didn't cover enough bases in those long, long books. Early Christianity and Judaism shunned the practice of cremation. Christians saw it as a pagan practice, and there was just a very strong tradition in the Jewish faith of sepulchre, entombment. Emperor Constantine, or Constantine, You know what he went and did?
Burned everyone.
He Christianized the empire.
Oh no, Nero was the one who watched Rome burn.
No, he was busy fiddling.
Who didn't watch Rome burn.
That's right.
But there was burning involved with that one.
To be clear, that was playing a fiddle, not...
Well, I feel like lots of ancient texts are mistranslated, so he could have been masturbating.
That's a really good point. Ancient scholars, do write in and tell us all about emperors masturbating. Emperor Constantine, by about 400 CE, Emperor Constantine had Christianized the empire, and burial almost entirely overtook cremation as the form of disposition, except in cases
of... The main form of...
Disposition. That's another way of saying getting rid of a body.
You wouldn't just say main form of disposal. You can actually call it disposition.
Yeah, I quite like the word. It puts me in mind simultaneously of a wonderful funeral and setting a body on fire and just hurling someone's lifeless corpse out of a 14th story window. Interment took over cremation hugely as the main form of disposal, except in cases of plague or war. And that's another case of how convenience overrides considerations of faith or dignity. The French Revolution. Heard of that? It's one of the really good ones.
Yes, very bloody.
I think Ratatouille was invented during it. And without that invention, we wouldn't have got the hit Disney Pixar movie Ratatouille.
What does this have to do with cremation?
French Revolution. Revolutionaries and anarchists during that time promoted cremation as a way of reducing the church's involvement with how they dealt with their families and friends. In the decades and centuries following, there was a lot of experimentation into developing a workable retort. So before we reach the...
Like a witty reply, like...
Yeah, go on, give us a witty reply.
Everyone's cremating.
Yeah?
How are we going to reply to this in a witty fashion?
Give us an example of that retort.
Well, I didn't invent the retort, okay, so I don't know. So, a witty retort. Let's continue.
Into the modern era.
So this is post-revolution.
It was before the invention of the retort, which is where the big turnaround comes. Stop.
They used to grinning. Just call it a comeback.
Stop! And if anyone was insulted, they would just have to stand there and take it. Up until the French Revolution. I'll tell you what happened. Up until the mid-19th century, everyone actually died by catching fire. So...
Oh, spontaneous combustion was usually what happened.
Literally everybody died of spontaneous combustion. So to cremate someone, you just leave them.
Cool.
Nature would take care of the rest. Until the Cremation Society was formed in 1874 in London by Queen Victoria's own surgeon, a man called Sir Henry Thompson. And that was, again, a pragmatic concern. It was in response to overcrowded burial grounds and expensive funerals in Victorian England.
Of course, because they used to only be able to be buried in consecrated ground.
Exactly.
If you were of a church-going persuasion.
Of course.
Guess what? Pretty much everyone was. Atheism was not really taking off back then.
Yeah, atheism was still a sleeper movement at the time.
You could still get kicked out of Oxford University for atheism. Shout out my man Shelley.
In 1878, that society, after 4 years, established a crematorium in Woking, and in Europe, in Gotha in Germany, another one was established around the same time. And they quickly got to work and successfully tested the furnace on a horse, which is a classic way throughout history of seeing if things will work on humans. If they work on humans, they normally work on horses.
And vice versa, I would imagine.
Immediately, the use of that new crematorium established in Woking in 1878 was banned on the grounds that it could be used to destroy a body before it was searched for evidence of murder. And I think evidence of murder at the time of 1878 was probably pretty much only the murder of signing the corpse.
Yeah, they weren't very good at figuring out what evidence was.
They were rubbish at it. I don't think they'd even caught Dr. Crippen by that time. The first person to be officially legally cremated in the UK was Jeanette Pickersgill, a painter. She was cremated in 1885. She died on March the 20th, and she was cremated 6 days later. To teach you about Jesus Christ.
I know a lot about him. He's a superstar.
In 1883...
Came down from heaven on a Yamaha.
Did he?
That's the lyrics. It's not the real lyrics.
No.
Jesus Christ. Superstar. Looks came like down from a man, but he wears a bra. Oh, different.
We went to different schools.
We did.
Dr. William Price was a neo-druid, an anti-vivisectionist, an advocate of free love, a vegetarian, and a man who knocked up his housekeeper. She gave birth to a child. He called it Jesus Christ.
This guy sounds amazing.
He's a pretty good historical figure. This is in 1883.
Of course,
Dr. William Price.
My favourite era, the era full of mad people.
The child died at 5 months old, unfortunately. And here's what Dr. William Price did. He erected a pyre, and being that he was a druid, he cast the level one spell Create Bonfire, and he cremated his child in the open air, which is something I'll mention in passing, extremely fuel inefficient. You can burn up to 600 kilograms of wood. There was a public furor. Price was tried, and the ruling was that cremation was not illegal, provided no nuisance was caused. It wasn't until 1902 that an Act of Parliament was finally passed and made it legal for the Home Secretary to regulate cremation.
It's only just over 100 years ago.
114 years ago at time of recording, by extension, making it possible to make a social institution of it. Quickly, crematoria were opened up in Manchester, Glasgow, Hull and Liverpool and London. Question.
How did the general public react to crematoria suddenly springing up?
There was certainly opposition, largely on religious grounds. Christian denominations in general and the Roman Catholic Church in particular were very, very strongly against it. A lot of other people were okay with it. There was actually quite positive reception to the idea of affordably and sensibly disposing of your loved ones. Having a plot in a cemetery is not cheap. There was an equal level of dignity without so much expense and hassle to keeping a beautiful urn in the home.
What about health concerns in terms of cremation being a healthier alternative when it came to the sort of miasma theory of disease?
Oh, certainly. Particularly for people, as I said, who couldn't afford a cemetery plot. Yes, it was easier to get rid of the body entirely in a time when people could be forgiven for thinking that bad air is rising off a corpse the moment the life leaves it. 1902, that Act of Parliament was passed, and in the 114 years since, cremation has really, really taken off. By 2007, 72% of deaths across the UK resulted in cremation.
That's loads!
It is a lot.
Burn everyone!
Given that 120 odd years earlier, three cremations resulted from 600,000 deaths in the year of 1885. Strangely enough, and I couldn't find an explanation for this, the proportion is much, much higher in England. 75% in England, between sort of 20 and 40% in Scotland and Ireland. And much like the Union Jack, the Union Flag, Wales just isn't mentioned.
That's really interesting. Maybe English people are just pyromaniacs.
Maybe we've just got too many people.
I want to know some cool, funky, weird things about cremation. It's had a long history, time when it fell out of favour, but now cremation has come back.
I've got good news. Your skull's not going to explode.
Oh, I didn't think it was, but good, good.
It was an enduring myth about cremation that if you didn't bore a hole in the skull, it would somehow pressurise like a water balloon and pop. And that's rubbish. I want to dispel a few more myths. Cremation's eco-friendly. It really isn't. In the process, about 200 odd kilograms of CO2 are produced. Cremains, which is what's the word where the two words are a word?
Portmanteau.
For cremated remains. Cremains are not ashes. What you receive after a cremation is not the same as ashes. Cremains are in fact bone fragments, and they are pounded by a machine called a cremulator into a fine dust. So what you are handed...
Bone dust!
Is bone dust.
Bone dust!
Yeah, so you're not being given a jar of ashes.
Oh, here's a myth that I think might be real. Your ashes get mixed up with a whole bunch of other people's...
Well, it depends on what extent you mean. There are very rigorous measures put in place to make sure that one person...
I only get grandma back.
That you only get grandma back. That said, a lot of grandma is in the sky. And inside a cremation retort, bits will get stuck in corners. And it's perfectly possible that when the cremains are blown or scraped out, someone else's bits might end up in there with it.
Actually, if you want to read a really, really great account of working in a crematorium, you should read Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Caitlin Doughty. It really does reveal what it's like working in a crematorium.
Also watch her YouTube series, Ask a Mortician.
Mortician!
Yeah, it's a wonderfully informative and very fun series. Would you like to hear some celebrities who were cremated?
Give me a list.
Hunter S. Thompson's cremains were mixed into fireworks and shot out of a 153-foot memorial tower at his funeral celebration. Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek, had his ashes shot into space. And that's something you can do. It's a company called Celestis will fire you into space for a modest fee.
That sounds cool. I'd do that.
Do you know what the inventor of the Frisbee did with his ashes? He had them turned into a Frisbee.
Wow.
Do you know what the inventor of Pringles had done with his ashes?
He didn't turn them into Pringles.
He put them in a Pringles can.
Okay, but he didn't turn them into Pringles and make all his friends eat them.
Every Pringle has a little bit of Mr. Pringle in it.
There's an episode of Ask a Mortician where someone asks if you can bake ashes into a cake.
Tried it, doesn't work.
Yeah,
Albert Einstein was cremated, except for his brain, which we kept. And I think it's still in a freezer somewhere. It's not our freezer, though, I'm sure.
Oh, good.
Buddha was cremated.
Cool.
Old Siddhartha. Tradition states that his funeral pyre was self-ignited. Rubbish. Rudyard Kipling, Walt Disney, George Harrison, John Lennon, Sigmund Freud, JFK, Christopher Reeve, T.S. Eliot, and Alfred Hitchcock. Two people quite important to me. Maria Callas, Amy Winehouse. There's a long, long list of celebrities who have been cremated. Only one that I know of whose ashes were rolled into a blunt and smoked. Any guesses?
Bob Marley?
Tupac. Tupac founded a hip-hop collective called Outlaws, and they interpreted one of the lines of his songs to mean that he wanted them to smoke his ashes when he died.
It can't be good for you to inhale burning bone dust.
Those guys seem to get away with it. Do you have fillings?
I don't, actually.
The average person has about 3 grams of mercury in their teeth. Since 2012, the British government has stipulated that all crematoria must be fitted with special filters
to stop mercury gas going
into the atmosphere, which is very bad because you end up with holes in your brain like all those cats in China. Question from Rosie.
How hot does a cremation retort have to be to burn an entire human body? I reckon we don't burn easy. We're quite watery meat.
Depending on the start... I'm always going to look in the mirror now and think, that's watery meat. Oh, watery meat is terrible.
I don't know how else to describe a human body.
I can think of a few ways other than watery meat.
Well, but like our muscles are meat, but we're also 75% water.
Watery meat, the mankind story.
No, but it's true, and I don't think something that's 75% water would burn particularly well. It's very meaty.
It very quickly dries out when exposed to temperatures of 1,000 to 1,500 degrees.
That's so hot.
It's very, very hot. You know what it isn't, though?
What?
Fire. Cremation does not involve fire.
What?
It's bizarre to think of it, but the modern cremation process does not involve fire. The incinerator is very painstakingly heated to the appropriate temperature. Fire is not directly applied to the body. I'm going to run you through the process that your body's going to go through on its way through the world of cremation. A coroner or a medical examiner has to sign off. It gets a big Sharpie, signs across your belly, okay to cremate, tick, smiley face.
Boob emoji.
Dr. McShenanigans. Coroner or medical examiner has to sign off that no medical investigations need doing. And you don't have to do that with burial because you can always dig them up later. Pacemakers, which are explodey devices and will explode if put in fire hotness. Other prostheses and silicon implants have to be removed, something that is not required for alkaline hydrolysis. Jewelry is removed from the body. The body is then going to be put into a flammable container, sometimes wood, sometimes cardboard. The incinerator will be preheated to, I should have said, by the way, when I said 1,000 to 1,500 degrees, that's Fahrenheit. A jet of heat will then be fired at the torso, which will ignite that container and dry the body out very quickly. The skin begins to blister and split. The muscles start to tear, discolour. They will sometimes jerk, giving the impression that the body is moving around. Bones then begin to calcify, and they begin to flake and crumble, and after between 1 and 3 hours, the result you have is 1.4 to 4.1 kilos of cremains, and the amount depends not on the person's overall weight, but on their bone structure. The chamber's then cooled, the cremains are swept out with a big, big broom, and a powerful magnet is passed over them to pick up any metals. They're then shoved into a machine called a cremulator, where a system of either ball bearings or blades will grind those bone fragments into a fine, fine ash. Often a disc identifying the individual's cremains will be kept with them. Thereafter, it's up to the family what happens with them. Would you like to hear some options? The most popular way of dealing with them is either scattering, burying them, keeping them in the home, or putting them in a columbarium, mausoleum for ashes.
I've seen one of those. It's like a big wall with lots of little nameplates on it.
That's right, tiny little nameplates. I've got a picture of Peter Lorre's. You could be planted as a tree. You could have your ashes mixed into a root ball of a tree and be planted. You can have your ashes put into a big old helium balloon, which will float 5 miles up.
I know one. Question. Yeah. I know one. Put into a special thing that will turn into a coral reef.
You can. It's called an eternal reef. They're very, very beautiful. Google them if you like. Yeah, they're really gorgeous. Sort of hollow dome-shaped structures with holes in them so that fish can come and go and build their homes very quickly. Sea anemones and other
corals
and corals start to make their homes. Very beautiful circle of life things. You can be put into an hourglass. It won't keep reliable time. That's right. You can be turned into a bad timepiece.
It sounds like you can do pretty much anything crazy imagination comes
up. You can have your ashes smashed into a diamond. It can be mixed into paint and turned into a work of art. It can be put into a plastic bag and a teddy bear. You can get turned into pencils. You can get pressed into a set of vinyl records by a company called Vinyly. A very beautiful one. It can have your ashes mixed into glass and blown into a glass structure. Tattoo ink can be made using ashes. And you can be turned into a tattoo. You can be turned into stained glass. You can be put into some bullets. If you're really, really dedicated to gun loving, you can be put into bullets and fired off by some people in the ceremony, encased in jewellery, or if you're in a society which is not necessarily particularly close to ours, eaten. There is...
In a cake. No.
In a cake. Bad. Yes. You ash can be turned into a cake.
Don't eat ash cake.
Ugh. Oh, no, it's delicious. In Hinduism, cremation is one of 16 life rituals. It's considered to usher the soul into the next world or into rebirth. It's an expression of the ephemerality of physical life and the eternity of spiritual life. Dave Brocky from a thrash metal band called Gwar, and this is what I want to, what I really want to end on. Dave Brocky, as expressed in his will, was given a genuine Viking funeral by his friends and bandmates.
Oh my god.
You can look this up. There's a fantastic video of it. There's a great old ceremony. I think the video is about 45 minutes long. Dave Brocky, B-R-O-C-K-I-E, of the band Gwar, G-W-A-R. So Google that. As we saw from Game of Thrones, they can be very embarrassing if your aim is bad. We all remember Lord Hoster Tully's embarrassing funeral.
I feel
funeral.
Like your digressing feels a little bit dire.
What could that possibly mean? Could it be the direful digression?
Another tangent.
It's a tangent. It's tangent time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed learning a little bit about cremation so far.
If you have enjoyed listening to our first episode and are enjoying this episode, there are many ways you can interact with us and tell us that we're doing a good job.
The best way to spread the word about what we're doing here is by asking you to spread the word about what we're doing here. If you like what you're hearing, please, please tell your friends. Word of mouth is hugely important in getting a new podcast
off the ground. So, with that in mind, here are ways you can tell people about it. We are at Jim Crack Shows on Twitter. Shows. If you use Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1. That is the numeral one, not spelled O-N-E.
And Instagram.
Instagram, we are JimCrackProductions. And we got a website, JimCrackProductions.com. Please interact with us across all these platforms.
We'd love to hear from you.
Hearing from you.
Those of you who listened to last week's episode will know that we set up a sort of informal listeners competition. What would your death email be? If you woke up having been buried alive and had your iPhone or your smartphone or your laptop, who would you email and why?
Who would you email and what would you say? With that in mind, we got some hilarious responses.
People are ridiculous.
People are brilliant. Do not ridicule our amazing people that responded to this. So Neil said he'd arrange a rescue. Obviously. Probably use it as an opportunity to start his vlog. It would make a pretty gripping first episode. And he'd maybe email a local radio station and get them to play I Want to Break Free to help keep his spirits up, which I thought was brilliant. A lot of people said they would use Google Maps to send a screenshot of where they were to the police or some sort of rescuing party. One of my favourite ones was from the amazing Lady May, who said she would text the guy that recently ghosted on her and send a coffin selfie with the line, "This is how you ghost someone, you dick."
Nice. That's
and then she also said nice she'd stuff. Maybe get a cheeky bit of Botox lined up so she could really come back from the grave looking better than ever. Oh, Mila said she'd email the coroner and ask, "What the f-?"
Yeah, WTF.
I would ask that too of the coroner if he'd buried me. Roxy would text people saying, "I was only sleeping, you f***. Hope you saved me some food and alcohol from the wake."
I would just be too busy looking for diglets.
And she'd also order a Domino's. I said I would say what mine would be. I would actually probably send a message to you.
Aww.
My darling. Saying.
Saying what?
Haunting you. JK, please come get me buried alive.
Okay, that doesn't help me at all. All that means is that you're underground. I have to look everywhere.
Well, no, hopefully you'd know where you'd buried me if I'd had a funeral.
Why is it me who buried? Oh, I see, because funeral.
Yeah, we're talking about not, like, on purpose someone maliciously burying you alive. Like, did you not listen to last episode that you were definitely in? So thank you, everyone, so, so much for giving me all these brilliant answers. Al, Rosemary, Red Sarah, Roxy, Neil, Lady May, Maisie Martini, Kim, Ruth as well, Sophie. You made my morbid day.
I think this week's listener question should be, what original thing would you want your ashes turned into?
Oh yeah, what would you do with your cremain? Get in touch on all the avenues we mentioned before.
How personalised you can get with your cremains.
Or you could tell us in person, because you can see us everywhere.
All over the shop.
Yes. We've got some shows coming up.
Gymcrackery!
Well, the first one is Apothecary Cabaret.
Gymcrackery!
Gymcrackery, yes. But first, date-wise, 5th of October.
Gymcrackery! No, that's Apothecary Cabaret.
Exactly. We're doing this chronologically.
If you are desperate, you poor things, for more of me, I will be comparing a cabaret show up in Stoke Newington. It's a wonderful, wonderful night. It's called Apothecary Cabaret. Happens at Haunt. That's on
Wednesday the 5th of October. We have our brand new vaudevillian extravaganza coming up on Sunday the 9th of October. That is Gymcrackery.
A vaudevillian display of daring curiosity.
Exactly. It's going to be magical.
It is going to be an amazing night.
It's in the fabulous Crazy Cox Bar at Brasserie ZL in the heart of London's Piccadilly. It starts at 9 p.m. You can still get tickets. It's going to be amazing.
It's beautiful. And the lineup we have is stunning.
And we've got a few surprises up our sleeves. So come.
It's going to be really weird.
London won't know what has hit it. So come and see us. Got any other dates? Oh, Cabaret Roulette!
Cabaret Roulette on the 12th.
Whoop, whoop, yeah!
October, at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern.
Wednesday, 12th of October, Royal Vauxhall Tavern. Come see us do an act based on the theme Revolution. And if you want to see all these dates, they are all over our website.
gymcrackproductions.com.
God, where did we go?
That must have been a direful digression. But we're back now. I hated it.
Yeah, me too.
Mm. There must be something to lift my spirits.
Ooh, maybe I'll find a different topic then.
Something lively.
Actually,
something active.
This half of the podcast might get pretty gnarly. So if you're squeamish, I would possibly consider taking this section in bite-sized chunks.
Oh, no.
That you could handle.
Don't eat corpses.
No. Well, we're continuing along our theme of corpses because we're talking about death. And if you decide not to cremate...
If you decide not to cremate, did you say?
Yes.
And speaking of D...
D is for the best joke. What did Beethoven do after he died?
Rot.
He decomposed! Decomposition. D is for decomposition.
I understand.
Get it? Beethoven was a composer, and
sure.
Then after he died,
he
would decompose.
Living and rotted.
Decomposed.
Decayed.
Yes, decay is another word for it.
Yes. Decomposition.
What is it?
It's what Beethoven did after he died. High
I
five.
Made that joke! No! No high five for you. Death is defined as when all your vital bodily functions stop. So you're breathing, your heartbeat, and electrical activity in the brain. Decomposition is actually already happening in your body.
No, it isn't.
Well, because decomposition basically just means breaking down, essentially. What we're talking about now is your entire body breaking down.
Sure.
After the moment of death, when it stops happening just in your digestive system, where you're breaking down food and begins to happen all over your body.
All over the shop, starting, I assume, from the gut outwards.
In a way, there are several different processes that happen, so it's actually easier to take it in a sort of timeline of what happens from the moment of your death onward.
What's the first thing I'm going to notice as I stand over my rotting corpse, watching it?
The signs of decay will not obviously be immediately visible because moments before you had been a living, breathing person. The first thing that happens that is noticeable is pallor mortis. So you may have heard of mortis before, rigor mortis.
It's yeah.
Quite the famous mortis. There are a few.
That's the Alec Baldwin of mortises.
Yeah, there are other Baldwin brothers of Mortis.
So Palamortis is
Palamortis is the first one, and that basically just means deathly pallor. Because the blood is no longer circulating, there's no pinkness, lividity, they call it,
sure,
to your body. The pupils begin to have a glassy appearance, and your body temperature begins to drop because your oxygen levels are depleting and you are no longer burning caloric energy to keep your body heated. Within the first 10 minutes, because your blood is no longer circulating through the body, it starts to pool, which causes a discoloration in your body. So because it's no longer evenly distributed, so spots of colour begin to come up. That is called livor mortis.
That's Daniel Baldwin. Okay, so we start with Jason Baldwin, and then after 10 minutes later, we got Daniel Baldwin.
Yes. We've got two Baldwin brothers of death. We've got Palamortis and then livor mortis. Uh-huh. So you go pale and then spots of discoloration begin to appear. The muscles actually relax first, which results in the bowels and bladder beginning to empty. And you will often notice corpses do allow the remaining fecal matter to escape. Corpse poo.
Corpse poo.
It does happen. Other things that happen are brain cells begin to die.
Oh no!
A lot of brain cells die.
Oh, all that hard work.
And your brain begins to get mushy.
Mine already is.
Liquid. The pupils are no longer responsive to light, and the eyes begin to cloud over, which actually comes from potassium in the red blood cells breaking down. And that process can usually take a bit longer, but because a lot of people die with their eyes open, the process often occurs in this early first 10-minute time frame. Some forensic scientists actually believe that that is a better indication of the time of death than body temperature, rigor mortis, or livor mortis. The other thing that happens that's kind of gross is your eyeballs flatten due to loss of blood pressure. And at the end of the first 10 minutes or so, the brain stem dies. Within the first few hours, rigor mortis begins to set in. And you know a lot about rigor mortis, I've heard.
I'm going to call it Alec Baldwin. Do I know a lot about Alec Baldwin? I mean, he's the greatest actor on earth.
No, you don't know. I don't know how much you know about Alec Baldwin, but you know a lot about rigor mortis because we've done an act all about rigor mortis.
We have. It's called The Rigor Mortis Tango.
You can see that in our hit show, Moribund. So tell me, rigor mortis guru.
Yeah.
What causes rigor mortis?
There's this chemical called the adenosine triphosphate, and it's essentially the source of chemical energy in the cells of the body. And when the cells begin to die, and that stops being produced, the muscles essentially lock up.
So ATP, adenosine triphosphate.
That's right.
That's what causes your muscles to be pliable.
Yeah.
Yeah. One interesting thing about this is that it can also cause the hairs on the body to stand up, because the muscles are tensing, and if you think about, there are tiny, when you get goosebumps, there are tiny, tiny reactions, and that can cause people to believe that the hair is actually growing after death, which is a myth. It can also be quite spasmodic, because the muscles stiffen, they also contract, so there can be some very, very strange positions that people move into, as we discussed in the Buried Alive section of the podcast last week. At 6 hours, muscles continue to spasm sporadically, and processes that don't need oxygen, known as anaerobic processes, like the liver breaking down alcohol, actually continue. So anything that does not require oxygen in your body is a process that will continue to happen. And at 8 hours is when the body really starts to get very cold, which is called algor mortis.
Adam Baldwin?
Yeah. This is the faster process of cooling. It's different to the initial cooling process. After 24 hours, rigor mortis actually ends and the body actually becomes pliable again. So it becomes very, very stiff during the first few hours after death. And then after about 24 hours of being slightly distressing to look at, actually relaxes again. If the body is in a mortuary at this point or has been discovered, sometimes the undertaker takes advantage of this stage to present the body at the funeral and is able to arrange the body into a nice position for presentation. At 24 to 72 hours, this is when we talk about autolysis.
That science word that I knew.
Yes, the science word that is a really lovely science word that sounds very pretty, but actually means your body digesting itself from the inside out.
Yummy, yummy. The thanatomicrobiome.
Yes, exactly. So you've got a microbiome in your gut. So that's a whole bunch of bacteria in your gut. And as they digest food, when you are no longer living, they begin to digest you. So the bacteria, pretty much as soon as you've died, begin to get to work at all the stuff in your gut. And after about 24 to 72 hours, it really intensifies. And that's when the little bacteria really get to work eating you and start producing all kinds of gases. And your pancreas begins to get eaten in particular. And it's really lovely.
If anyone at home is listening and thinking that this is sort of gross or somehow demoralizing, just remember the real message here is that you are delicious.
To bacteria. Yeah. It pretty much liquefies your insides. I don't really know what else to say about that section. After 3 days, the decay starts to produce blisters all over the body. And if the body hasn't been found until now, it probably will be pretty hard to salvage for some kind of open casket ceremony.
At what point after death does the body cease being huggable?
Let's experiment.
Okay.
You go find some dead bodies in different stages of decay and try giving them some hugs.
You joke, but there are body farms.
Yes, and I'm going to talk about them in a bit.
Good.
Because your insides are liquefying, there's loads of gases and things. Blood vessels begin to break down, as do your lungs, and lots of gases are coming out, so sort of bloody froth will occasionally come out of the mouth. After about a week, all the gases inside the body really build up that are given off by the bacteria. This is what they call the bloat stage of decomposition, where you are very bloated. The body definitely swells. This is the point where it starts to smell, about 5 to 7 days. This is also when the tongue will start to protrude out of the mouth because of the swelling of the tissues in the neck and face. This is what also makes it really hard to identify at this point if it's found at this stage.
So you could find it and you'd know it was a Baldwin, but you'd have no way of knowing which Baldwin.
I don't even know if you'd know if it was a Baldwin at this point.
Oh, crikey. Well, that's...
Honestly, I haven't seen a corpse at this stage of decomposition before. The formation of gases also causes any remaining feces or liquid in the body to be forced out.
I've heard that makes a very interesting sound. What sort of sound would you make if you were reading the notes that you'd written that I have a copy of right here?
Forgot to cut that out. I copied and pasted that off the internet.
Okay, do tell. I mean, it's written down now, so you have to say it.
It sounds like the ultimate wet fart.
The ultimate wet fart, ladies and gentlemen.
The colour of the body also changes from pink and lots of purplish, blackish bruises to very green as the red blood cells in there really start to decompose.
So that's after about a week.
Yep. And then the skin begins to liquefy from the internal gases and the decay after that. Because of all the gases building up, it can often cause the various tissue layers to separate as well, and you get something that's called skin slippage.
Yeesh.
Depending on the environment, this is the point where the body may also start to dry out if you're in a very dry environment. Several types of insects feed on the body if you're outside, or if they manage to get inside and they're not in a climate controlled environment, and kind of aid the decomposition process. When a dead body is left out, some of the first insects on the scene are blowflies, and that's often what you see in movies and things, is you get the sound of the flies and the flies on the corpse face. TV shows like to do that as well. Your body basically becomes a smorgasbord for bacteria and small invertebrates, depending on where you are.
You are delicious.
Yeah, really. That's another way you could potentially identify things like time of death or location of death, is by what insects are on the body and what stage of development their larvae are, if they've laid eggs. So the study of entomology is really interesting when it comes to crime scene investigations. Something I didn't know before I really started researching this is that a dried out body is considered mummified. It's not just the process the Egyptians did with wrapping them in bandages. Mummification is the drying out of the body, and a body is also considered mummified when all of the organs are gone due to the feeding of insects.
So what defines mummification in general?
Dried out, organs gone. Interesting, huh?
I think there must be sort of true mummies and hedge mummies. For me, a mummy is going to be racket managers.
Yeah, me too. I like them. One of the final things that happens during decomposition after several months is the fat in the body breaking down. A corpse can smell for many months.
Oh, I bet.
So after about a week, the smell doesn't tend to go away for quite a long time. And it's not really until the fat starts properly breaking down that the smell begins to go away.
I know this.
Yes, you do.
Breaks down into grave wax.
Yes.
Adipocere.
Yes, adipocere. Grave wax. In the 17th century, some individuals were apparently known to use adipocere to make candles for the use at the vigil of the body they'd taken the grave wax from.
We may or may not have mentioned our hit show Moribund, where you could also learn that fact.
The other thing about grave wax is that it can also be a preservative. So it can hopefully help preserve some of the facial features or identifying features on the corpse.
So your own fat could break down into adipocere and it could then be applied to your own face?
No, it would like come to the surface and it would hopefully stop it from decaying even further. So if you found a body at this stage, post-bloat, when everything had shrunk back down and the tissues had stopped swelling, you might be able to gain some kind of recognition. And finally, once the skin has either liquefied and the grave wax has really broken down or it's really dried out, all you really get left are the sort of leathery remnants of skin, unless, of course, that's all been eaten by carrion eaters such as vultures or
cats,
raccoons, possums, hyenas, that squirrels. Kind of thing. I don't know if squirrels eat corpses.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they do.
Rats. Rats would eat a corpse. Finally, it's bones. You're left with bones. Once the bones have even reduced to dust, you're more likely to be left with teeth, which is why a lot of people use dental records to identify people. Enamel is some of the most resilient substance in the entire body. So that is the process that you go through from the moment of death right up until the very end. And if you want to know a bit more about, I've talked a lot about identification. There's a really, really brilliant book called Working Stiff by Dr. Judy Melinek, and she describes what it's like to work as a medical examiner and some of the identification processes they use. I really recommend it.
The time span that you've just been telling us about is some months, and I assume that's hugely variable.
It is very variable, basically depending where you've died, if/when you're found. I'm assuming for the purposes of this entire process of decomposition that you have not been found, or if you have been found, this is happening underground, so it's unlikely that a vulture will be underground, or as mentioned last week, a badger would be underground. But there could be vermin such as rats, mice, beetles, carrion beetles, larvae, all that kind of thing. Other things that really affect the process of decomposition are temperature, humidity, whether you're indoors or outdoors. Some environments will do different things than others. We actually know relatively little about human decomposition.
Oh.
And it's only within our, I would say, modern history that Texas State University, set up what they call the body farm, where they have all kinds of different atmospheric conditions, and they have people who have donated their bodies to the body farm to study decomposition under different conditions.
And good for them.
Yeah, it's an amazing piece of work because it really does help crime investigators and just help us understand the process of human decomposition a lot more. And there are a couple of weird things that can happen during decomposition.
Oh, I bet there are. Yeah. Let's hear it.
The one thing that really struck me was, we've spoken about rigor mortis and how it can contort your body into strange positions, but sometimes rigor mortis can set in immediately and freeze the person at the precise moment of their death. So the idea, you know, of dying of fright and the look of horror on the person's face.
Oh, nice.
It's extremely rare, but it does happen, particularly when the death is very, very violent or associated with intense physical exertion. Every now and then you'll have a first responder, like a paramedic, happen upon an incident where the facial expressions and the gestures of the person have basically been crystallized in time.
What other mad stuff can a body go through?
Well, I mentioned the gas.
The ultimate wet fart gas?
Yeah, the gas that causes the
ultimate wet fart.
the expulsion of remaining matter. Humans have invented these things called caskets, which are different to coffins because they are big metal airtight boxes. And if you put a thing in an airtight box that is producing lots of gas...
I feel like I can see where this is going to go. It's going to go kaboom.
Yes, it is going to explode. There have been incidents of caskets exploding. I feel as though this does not happen in the modern day because I think casket technology is such that maybe they've bored at least one hole in there.
I would think after the first few times that happened, someone would come up with that, yeah.
Well, you know, people didn't really know why caskets would explode in the past. They didn't study decomposition, had they?
So. Depending on how far back you're going, they probably thought it was the devil doing some stuff.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Satan's fingers grasping up the earth going, this one's mine!
Boom. Yeah. One particularly gross thing, and I will leave you with this delightful thought, talked about skin slippage.
Skin slippage. It's as much fun to watch as it is to say.
It can get to the point where if you made a circular cut around the wrist, you could slip the skin of the hand off like a glove.
And thus unlock their iPhone using their fingerprints.
Well, if you stuck your hand into their skin glove, yes. Yeah. I mean, the initial thought was disgusting enough. You've just made it extra gross. Thank you very much, darling.
Well, we've been Ed Gein. Thank you for listening to the podcast.
Oh, no. Pretty disgusting, right?
Pretty grody.
No.
It's... No?
No.
No, it isn't.
It's natural. It's basically what your body wants to do. Decompose. I'm sure when we talk more about preservation, it will become clear that our neuroses around avoiding decomposition are a very Western idea. Western ideology really loves preserving people in a moment in time. So we do all kinds of things to bodies to stop them from decomposing, even though we're just about to put them in the ground. Initially, decomposition is gross, and it inspires a natural instinct of revulsion and fear. I've read a really interesting book called Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, where he discusses our deep, deep fear and our deep drive towards immortality. A lot of that is surrounding decomposition, and basically when we see decay, it is a reminder that our lives are finite. So, how do we learn to accept decomposition?
By looking into it, getting familiar.
Exactly, the way you deal with a lot of fears. Exposure therapy. We start thinking about it.
Go hug a corpse.
Maybe not get that close. Don't dive into a corpse.
Guys, don't dive into a corpse.
I wouldn't necessarily go there, but I would encourage everyone to start contemplating decomposition. Thinking about decomposition is not a new idea. Buddhist monks are known to do a meditation called the Cemetery Contemplations.
Cemetery Contemplations.
So this meditation aids in breaking one's attachment to one's body and to the bodies of others. With the contemplations, essentially they're there so that one realizes that oneself and everyone else will come to the same end. It's breaking that, what they describe as an arrogant idea that I'm going to live forever. A realization that the body is based on ephemeral conditions. And when those conditions cease, the body will be gone. It's a really lovely way of thinking about things. And actually, Caitlin Doughty, in an article on The Order of the Good Death, which I will put a link to in the episode description.
In the show notes.
Says, there is only a finite amount of matter to go around. At this very moment, dear living person, some of it belongs to you. The atoms that make up your body, your liver, your hair, your brain, your fingernails, are all on loan from the universe. While you are alive, the atoms have come together to make you. As soon as you are dead, they begin their dispersal back into the wide world. That's what decomposition is. It is the science of sending back everything the universe loaned you. The universe will reuse it as it sees fit, perhaps to make an eggplant or an aardvark, or perhaps even to make other new humans. Which I think is a really lovely sentiment. And while the process may be gross and icky, and we actually have a natural instinct to find it gross and icky to probably stop us doing things like
hugging a corpse,
eating putrefying flesh, we're designed to find decaying things disgusting as an instinct of self-preservation. If you are less squicked out by the idea of decomposition, or I urge you to get a little more comfortable with the idea of decomposition, because then I would also encourage you to consider natural burial, where you don't go through a hideous process, which is actually ridiculously invasive, and we're going to talk about this soon. You basically do what I have just quoted Caitlin saying. You are wrapped in a shroud and placed gently into the damp earth and you just decompose how nature would want you to decompose.
A beautiful way of sort of entering yourself into the cycle of nature.
Yeah.
To give energy as you have taken energy from the world. That sounded a bit hippy-dippy.
It did, but it's I kind of like it.
Not really what I
meant. Kind of nice.
Neil deGrasse Tyson said something similar, so I feel like I'm justified. The NDT's got my back. I can say whatever.
Oh, like I said, it's what your body wants to do. It's what we're designed to do. So why mess with that?
Why indeed? Folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 2 of the Morbid Curiosities podcast. We'll be back next Monday evening with the next two letters in the Cabinet of Death.
Yes, letters E and F, you're paying attention to your alphabet.
Which are going to be a surprise.
Yes.
We're not going to tell you what they are yet.
Yes. Please do get in touch with us. We love talking to you. Come see us at a show. You can find us on the internet.
On Facebook at
www.facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1. That is numeral 1, not O-N-E.
You can find us on Twitter at
JimCrackShows.
On Instagram at
JimCrackProductions.
And on our very own website at
JimCrackProductions.com. Thank you so much for listening. We really enjoy doing this podcast. I have been your host, Rosie Cole.
And I have been your other host, George Colley.
Stay morbid.
And stay curious.